I am on my way to becoming a millionaire. If Toke hadn't wormed his way into the Hicks line of succession, and if Vicky Pike hadn't murdered the son of a bitch, none of this would be happening. Conflicting emotions keep me awake deep into the night as I search for a calming thought to settle me down. I pull up the memory of Jeremy playing cards with our mother this morning, Kathy letting my brother win. I'd seen my mother happy at various times in my life, but not like what I saw today. This wasn't the careless glee that accompanied the opening of a new bottle of vodka or the passing delight tied to a new pair of jeans. What I saw this morning was deep down happiness, something new. I suspect that Jeremy saw it as well. Then I turn my thoughts to Angel. If Toke wasn't Angel's father, then Charlie has no claim to her. And just knowing that she'll be safe from Charlie lulls me deeper towards sleep. How I want to be there to see the look on Charlie's face when he learns that he isn't Angel's uncle, that his guardianship petition will fail. But I don't fall asleep until I conjure up a daydream of me walking into Bob Mullen's office to sign papers to split Jeannie's estate equally between Toke and Angel, the way it would have been if the world had known about Jeb being Angel's father. I'll inherit from Toke, and Angel will inherit from Jeannie. I can get by just fine on $3 million. The dream makes me smile because Mullen doesn't believe that I'll go through with it, but I will. I spin that scene over and over in my head, taking comfort in how it slows my pulse. Before I know it, sleep comes for me. Somewhere in the dark hours of morning, I wake from a dream. I don't remember the details of the dream, but I recall something about sliding down a hill toward a churning river. I remember the river because at first it smells of mud and rot, but the odor turns into the smell of gasoline. It becomes overpowering, and I wake up, but the smell of gasoline is still with me. Before I can make sense of it, my motel room erupts into flames, the whoomph of the ignited fuel hitting me like a cudgel, throwing me off my bed. The room lights up as fire licks its way toward the ceiling. I'm on the floor between my bed and the wall, staring at a curtain of fire that's blocking my path to the door and the window. The heat is unbearable. I have to get through the flames. I pick up the mattress off of my bed and throw it onto the burning carpet between me and the door. Then I grab my jeans and shoes and charge through the flames, jumping onto the mattress, using one of my pant legs as an oven mitt to try to open the door. The handle turns, but when I pull it, the knob jerks out of my hand and the door springs back shut. I yank again and feel that the door is caught on something. Then, through the small gap in the door, I see that someone has tied a small chain to the door handle, looping it around a bar across the doorframe outside. The heat is lashing at my skin as I fall back. Thick, black smoke is filling the room, burning my eyes. I can't breathe. I retreat into the bathroom, shut the door, and turn on the faucets in the sink and tub, closing the drains. I soak a towel and shove it under the door, and then slip into my shoes and jeans, all the while contemplating my failed attempt to get out of my room. Someone barred the door shut. Someone is trying to kill me. I shake that thought away. I need to focus on getting out. Think. The window? I'd never be able to wrestle the air conditioner out of the way with that whole wall on fire. And who's to say my attacker hasn't thought of that exit as well? I'd burn to death before I'd be able to get out. And why isn't the sprinkler going off? I stand on the edge of the tub and grab the sprinkler head. There's something wrong with it. Someone has packed it in epoxy. God damn him! I yell. I look at the mirror as the smoke seeps in, creating a veil that blurs my reflection. I could lie down in a tub full of water, but smoke inhalation would kill me even if I managed to survive the flames. My throat burns. My image in the mirror is getting hazier. Then an idea hits me. My escape is through the mirror. Beyond the mirror and the wall behind it is another bathroom and another motel room, one that's not on fire. I jump to my feet and lift the lid off the toilet tank, smashing it onto the tile floor. It breaks into a dozen pieces, one of which is shaped like a large slice of pizza. I pick up that wedge, close my eyes, and slam it into the mirror, ignoring the pain in my ribs. The glass shatters into a thousand shards that rain down onto the vanity. I wrap a towel around my hand to keep my tool from cutting me and drive the point of the porcelain into the drywall. It makes a smaller dent than I had hoped. I change my angle and start whacking away, cutting an ever-deepening groove in the wall with each chop. My chest is screaming in pain. but I keep chopping, white gypsum spraying and ricocheting against my arms as I strike again and again. As the cut expands, I see that there are two layers of drywall, a firewall. I chop harder. The flames have reached the bathroom door, and thin, yellow fingers are lapping through the crack. My eyes water from the smoke. I chop harder and feel my blade break through to the insulation. I put the tool down and slide my fingers into the cut, pulling until some nails pop. It's giving way. I grit my teeth and pull again, and a seam splits. One more pull, and a chunk of drywall about the size of a clipboard comes off. Flames are licking through the top of the door, the heat pricking at the skin on my left side. I can smell the odor of my own burned arm hair. I grip another section of wall and pull, ripping away another plate-sized section. This creates an opening big enough for me to wiggle through. I tear the insulation out of the wall and give the drywall on the other side a hefty kick. It doesn't budge. I kick again. Same result. The sink in front of me is full of water, and I use my hands to slosh water at the flames. It does no good. I dunk a towel in the water and drape it over my head and shoulders. The smoke is so thick that I can't see. I feel across the vanity until my hands fall on my porcelain tool. I close my eyes and stab the wedge at the wall, hitting it 5 times in quick succession. I hear the sound of glass breaking as the mirror on the other side of the wall splinters. I drop the tool and raise my foot again and kick. The wall pops out a little bit. I kick again, and this time, nails give way. My third kick sends my foot through the wall. I can't see. I've been holding my breath, and my lungs are about to explode. I put my face to the hole and suck in fresh air. I'm dizzy, but I can't wait for that to pass. I hold my breath again, close my eyes, and tear at the drywall with all I have until a big section breaks free. The door beside me is on fire. I jump onto my side on the vanity and stick my head through the hole. My shoulders get caught because the hole is too small. My arms need to go through first. I back out and slip my arms through, then my head. My hands grab for anything solid as I pull my torso through. The glass from the mirror slices into my skin as I crawl out of hell. When my legs slide through, I fall to the floor. A billow of smoke follows me through the hole, blooming and spreading on the ceiling of this new bathroom. I take a moment to cough and wheeze and catch my breath. But now that I am safe, my fear turns to rage. My only thought is to find the shovel-faced son of a bitch who tried to kill me and put an end to his miserable existence. Chapter 47. I charge out of room number 18, startling Mitch, the night manager, who is knocking on doors to get the last few guests out of bed. When he sees me, his face lights up.
You're alive? Christ, how?
Did you see anyone outside my room tonight?
I was sleeping when the alarm went off. Did you break through the...
Anyone lurking around earlier?
The guy from room 9 was sitting in his car when I took out the trash around midnight.
Charlie. I run around the backside of the motel, where the glow from the fire creates shadows that dance against trees. I hug the edge of the property until I circle to the parking lot in front of my burning room. A handful of guests have gathered, well back from the flames. Among them I see Jeb Lewis, barefoot, wearing jeans and a t-shirt. In the distance, I can hear the approach of the volunteer fire department cutting through town. I scan the crowd for Charlie, but don't see him. Then, as the fire trucks pull into the motel, their headlights sweep across the empty lot next door, and I catch a glimpse of the unmistakable outline of Charlie's Lexus. And there's Uncle Charlie, leaning against the front bumper, his arms folded across his chest. I ignore my bruised rib and take off on a dead run, charging past the cluster of guests in the parking lot. I hear Jeb shout my name, but I don't slow down. I don't take my eyes off Charlie. It's dark, but early shades of morning gray are filtering in from the east. In that penumbra, I can see that Charlie is looking at me, but he must not recognize me because he doesn't move. Maybe he can't believe his eyes, his thick brain refusing to accept the possibility that I am still alive, given the inferno spiking up through the roof where my motel room had been. When he finally realizes that it's me charging toward him, it's too late. He takes off running, old legs paddling as fast as they can, but Charlie doesn't stand a chance. He makes it to the mouth of an alley, but I tackle him before he can fully turn the corner. We go down together, me on his back, riding him like a sled. When the slide stops, he gets into a push-up position, trying to rise up off the ground, and I drive my fist into his back, landing it right between his shoulder blades. I hear his breath leave. I punch again, and my knuckles rattle loose, my wrist folding in. Pain shoots up my arm, and I pull my hand into my chest. Charlie makes a second attempt to get up, but I throw my shoulder into him, sending him back to the gravel. He's yelling something, but I don't listen. The only thing I hear as I grab the back of his head and shove his face into the ground is the voice in my head screaming, "Kill this man." I don't hear the footsteps approaching from behind me, but suddenly, two arms wrap around my shoulders and yank me off Charlie. I twist and land an elbow on someone's jaw. Breaking loose, I jump back on top of Charlie, hitting him in the back again. I want to crush his spine. I want to destroy his lungs. Again, the man's arms lock around my chest and pull me up. This time, I hear Jeb Lewis holler, "Joe, get off him!" He throws me to the side and I fall to the ground. When I look up, I see Jeb with his hand stretched out in a calm-the-hell-down position, standing between me and Charlie. "He tried to kill me," I say, scrambling back to my feet. Jeb's a big man, but I am determined. I take a step toward him. "What are you talking about?" Jeb asks. "That's my room on fire," I say, pointing to the blaze. "He barred my door. He locked me in and set my room on fire." Charlie rolls onto his side, coughing and spitting up what might be blood. When he talks, he sounds like he's swallowed glass.
"You saw him attack me."
Charlie's talking to Jeb and pointing at me.
"He tried to kill me. You saw it. Shut up, you psychopath."
I charge at Charlie again, but Jeb grabs me around my waist and pulls me back. I manage to land a kick to Charlie's ribs before I'm out of reach.
"He set your room on fire?"
Jeb asks.
"Yes." "Why?"
"Because of the Hicks farm. He wants to get guardianship of Angel so he can get his hands on her money. He thinks I'm in his way. The dumbass doesn't know that he's not even related to Angel."
"She's my niece," Charlie says. "I have every right to be her guardian if I want."
"She's not your niece, you fucking moron," I yell. "Toke wasn't her father. She's nothing to you." That catches Charlie off guard. He's sitting on his butt in the middle of the alley, and all he can do is look at me with the raised brow of a confused chimp. He glances at Jeb and then back at me.
"You're full of shit," he says. "Toke's her daddy. I know that for a fact."
"No," Jeb says. He turns to face Charlie, as if to give his next words extra heft.
"Toke wasn't her father. I'm her father. Angel's my daughter."
Jeb's words carry a deep sadness in them.
"You're lying."
"No," Jeb says. "I'm not."
"So trying to burn me alive was all for nothing," I say. "I didn't do any such thing," Charlie says as he climbs onto one knee. "Just stay put," Jeb says. "Don't move." "To hell with you. I don't have to listen to this bull."
He starts to stand up and Jeb is on him, twisting Charlie's arm behind his back and escorting him back to the ground.
"What the hell you doing?" Charlie yells.
"You smell like gasoline," Jeb says.
"Why is that?"
"Because he used it to set my room on fire," I say. Jeb pulls a cell phone from his pocket and dials 911.
"Yeah, it's Jeb Lewis. Did Nathan get called for the fire?"
He pauses as the dispatcher says something and then replies,
"I'm in the alley behind Billings Hardware. Could you send him over here?"
Another pause.
"I know, but I have a situation. Call it a citizen's arrest. I need someone with a badge to take over."
Chapter 48.
"You got no reason to arrest me," Charlie says.
He's grunting his words because Jeb has the man's arm twisted in the air and a knee in Charlie's back. "Arson," I say. "Attempted murder? Take your pick." Before the fire erupted, I could smell gas. Somehow he poured gas into my room, maybe under the door, or maybe he punched a hole through my window when I was gone.
"That's bullshit," Charlie mutters.
When I tried to get out, my door was barred shut. He chained some kind of rod across the jamb. I saw it. I know it was him.
You don't know diddly squat, Charlie says.
And the glue. I mime the way my finger groped at the sprinkler in the bathroom. The sprinkler head had dried glue on it.
You'd better let me up, Charlie says. This is police brutality. I'm not a cop, Jeb says, giving Charlie's wrist a tweak. This is just plain old citizen's brutality.
Jeb begins to inspect Charlie's fingers in the light of the street lamp.
Well, looky here, Jeb says. I do believe you have some kind of residue on your fingers. Is that glue?
I bend down to see, and there it is. A smudge of dried epoxy on the tips of his index finger and his thumb. A squad car slides into the alley and stops with its headlights trained on the three of us. Deputy Calder gets out, and Jeb tells Nathan to bring some evidence bags. When Nathan gets to where Jeb is holding Charlie to the ground, Jeb says,
Nathan, I need you to place this guy under arrest.
What for? Nathan asks.
I'm pretty sure he started the fire at the motel. Give me your knife.
Calder pulls a folding knife from its sheath and hands it to Jeb, whereupon Jeb uses the blade to peel a tiny chip of the glue off the tip of Charlie's finger.
Put this in an evidence bag. You'll also want to bag his hands and preserve his clothing. I can smell gasoline on them.
Why would he set the motel on fire?
Nathan asks.
He was trying to kill me, I say.
Calder looks at Jeb, and Jeb nods.
You have enough to hold him on suspicion of arson at the very least. Joe thinks that the sprinklers in his room had glue on them to stop them from working. That fits the MO of another case in Charlie's past.
Nathan leans down and gives a sniff.
Yeah, that's gas, all right.
This is bullshit.
Charlie is twisting and cursing as Nathan locks the man's wrists into the cuffs.
This ain't right. I was attacked.
Nathan and Jeb lift Charlie to his feet, and Calder takes him to the squad car.
I was assaulted. I'm the victim here.
Charlie is yelling those words as Calder tucks him into the back seat of the squad. When the door slams shut, Charlie's voice dies away. There's an awkward silence in the alley after Nathan leaves. In the glow of the streetlight, I see that I'm bleeding from a dozen or so small cuts to my torso. Some with tiny glass shards still embedded in them. But nothing too serious. The hair on my left forearm is gone, and I smell like burned protein. I run a hand over my scalp, and it feels like all my hair is still there.
Want to borrow a shirt? Jeb asks. I'm pretty sure my room got spared.
He starts back toward the burning motel. Your room?
I'm staying at the Caspian. My wife, well... Let's just say that things are a little complicated at home.
As Jeb and I walk beside each other, he doesn't act like he's angry with me. But I wonder if he knows that I was the one who brought his affair to light. I'm sorry, I say.
Why is that?
I'm the one who sent the hounds on you. He stops walking.
You did what?
It's my fault you got in trouble. I learned that Toke had gotten a vasectomy after my mom got pregnant. That started me thinking, and, well, then one thing led to another. I'm the one who figured out that you had an affair with Jeannie. We stop at the edge of the motel parking lot. Jeb keeps his gaze on the fire and says,
This isn't your doing, Joe. I brought this on myself. I'm the one who screwed things up.
Did you know Angel was your daughter?
No. I suspected that I might be her father. I even asked Jeannie about it once. She denied it, but still, deep down, maybe I knew.
Is that why you took Angel into the house that night? Jeb doesn't answer right away. We watch as two firefighters climb onto the motel roof and move to within 20 feet of the blaze, the brilliant yellow flames leaping skyward into a halo of smoke. Three others on the ground shoot a stream of water through what used to be the door to my room, and it sends up a burst of steam to mix with the smoke.
I wasn't thinking, Jeb says finally. I saw her lying on the ground. I really thought she hit Toke with that gear. I could hear Nathan's siren and I just reacted. I figured I'd come up with a story to explain it all before the dust settled. I screwed up, and for that I'll pay the price.
How bad is the price?
I've been suspended, and who knows about my marriage.
I'm sorry, I say again. You were a good cop. Jeb shakes his head.
I altered a crime scene. That's the opposite of being a good cop. That's about the biggest sin a cop can commit. Now I have to take my lumps.
We watch as the firefighters on the roof get their hose going, the second front having an immediate taming effect on the fire. Then Jeb says,
I've carried the secret of that affair around for 15 years. It's been killing me. Now it's out there. I had an affair. I'm Angel's father. There's a new normal, and we'll just have to deal with it.
Is that how your wife will see it? Jeb shrugs.
I suspect she'll come around someday. She's a good woman. She's hurting right now, but I think she'll come around. She'll have to, for Angel's sake.
How is Angel doing?
I got a call from the doctor last night. She's showing new signs of lucidity. I'm heading up to Mankato in a little bit, after I get cleaned up and things calm down here. Wanna come?
She's not my sister, I say, as if that is a perfectly good answer. Then,
I probably shouldn't. I understand.
She's going to need you, I say, probably more than any girl has ever needed a father. To that, Jeb just nods. The night is fading into the pink glow of dawn, and the volunteer firefighters are gaining the upper hand on the blaze, more smoke now than flame. They're calling out their progress as they choke off the spread of the fire.
My room is gone.
The rooms next to mine are partially damaged, but most of the motel has been spared. When it seems appropriate, Jeb walks to his room, far away from the damage, and comes back with shoes on his feet and a spare shirt in his hand. He tosses the shirt to me. As I'm putting it on, one of the fire trucks moves, and I see my car, parked nose in next to the remains of my room. The front of my car is a charred mess. Both tires are burned off, and I have to assume that everything under the hood followed suit. Belts, hoses, wires, anything plastic or rubber. I no longer have a car. Chapter 49. After they reduce the fire to smoldering coals, and after they tow my car down to Dub's repair, I remain sitting on one of those concrete parking stops, watching the firefighters mill around. I have no car. I have no place to stay. My wallet and my phone were both in my jeans pockets, so I should count myself lucky, but I don't. What I want more than anything is to go back to my apartment in St. Paul and back to Lila, but I can't do that. The sun is already warm, and it's not even 8 o'clock. I haven't moved from the parking lot because I have nowhere to go. I feel hungry and gross and untethered. There's not much I can do about those last two, but I can grab a bite to eat. And that's what gets me off my butt. I'm not going to Snipes Nest. Not that it would be open this early. But I'm pretty sure that Marv would spit in my food, given my role in setting the law after Vicky. I wonder if he even knows yet that she's on the run. As I walk through town, I spot a small cafe that I had noticed my first day in town and go in, taking the last available booth. The place is filled with old men wearing worn caps with logos like Pioneer, John Deere, and Peterbilt emblazoned on them. They're talking about crops and weather, but mostly they're talking about the fire, and a great many eyes follow me as I take my seat. The waitress, a plump gal with strawberry cheeks, brings me my eggs and bacon with a smile and keeps my coffee filled. Lila would be starting the first day of the bar exam about now. I wonder if she's thinking about me. I hope that she isn't. I've been too much of a distraction already. While I eat my breakfast, I put together a list of what I need to do that day. It includes things like find a new car, file an insurance claim on the old car, and figure out lodgings for the night. I still have one more night away from home before I can go back to St. Paul, and I don't think the Caspian Inn will be open for business anymore. I'm sure that my mother would let me stay at her place if I could figure out a way to get there. I ask the waitress if there is a car dealership in Buckley, and she tells me that the closest thing they have is Dub's Repair down the street.
He has a handful of used cars that he fixes up.
As I sit in the cafe, doing the math on how I might pay for a car It occurs to me that I'm half owner of a large farm just outside of town. Or at least I will be. That gets me to wondering if there might be some old truck tied to the estate that I could borrow until things get settled. With that hazy thought in mind, I pay my check and strike out for Bob Mullen's office. I arrive to find the door unlocked, so I let myself in. Bob is at his desk reading some papers. When he sees me, he walks out to the reception room to greet me.
I hear you've had quite the morning, he says.
You heard about the fire?
Things get around pretty fast here in Buckley. I also know about what happened out at Ray Pike's place yesterday.
Yeah, I guess I made a mess of things.
How do you figure?
Vicky got away, I say.
Not for long. They picked her up early this morning.
They did? Where?
Ray called his brother Don from the jail. Those calls are all recorded, and they heard Ray tell his brother to take camping supplies and food down to Vicky, who was hiding out on some sandbar in South Dakota. It wasn't hard to figure out.
Did they bring her back?
She's in jail in Yankton. She has to go through extradition.
I don't know why it made me sad to think of Vicky in jail, but it did. Are you going to represent her?
No, he says. Ray's sister called me up this morning. I'll be representing him on that standoff yesterday. I've been calling around to find an attorney for Vicky. I suspect Ray's going to sell everything he has to help Vicky out.
The phone rings, and Bob excuses himself to go answer it, closing his office door behind him. I sit in the chair behind Jeannie's desk to wait. The papers from the Moody Lynch case lay strewn where I had left them, so I decide to be helpful and put the file back together. As I'm sliding my papers into the accordion folder, I see a page that stands out as being different from the others. On the top of the page are the words, "I'm sorry." I pull the paper out and read it. It is a single page of writing, and at the bottom is the name Jeannie Hicks Talbert, typed, not signed. It's Jeannie's suicide note. I read it. "I'm sorry. I can't do this anymore. I can't fight the sadness. I have lived my life believing that my Bapu hated me and that I hated him too. Now I know I was wrong. My life has become a never-ending nightmare, and I can't stand the person I've become. I have been sad for so long now, and it is more than I can handle. My world is black. I am a terrible person for what I did, and I don't deserve to live. Angel, I know that this will hurt, and I know that I am being selfish, but this is the only outcome left for me. I see no other way out. Please forgive me. Toke, I ask for your forgiveness too, although I know you will find a way to make do without me. I'm sorry to leave you both this way. I love you, Angel. Goodbye. Jeannie Hicks Talbert." The letter sinks to my lap as the words and phrases on the page move around in my head, aligning like the internal workings of a combination lock. I can't believe what is happening. New facts begin to fall into order, making sense of one final loose end. From the next room over, I hear Bob's voice rise the way voices do when ending a call. He'll be coming out soon. I don't know what I'm going to do with the secret I've discovered. I need time to think. I take the suicide note and run out the door. There's more to Toke's death, and no one knows it but me. I walk against the breeze, blind to where I'm going. When I look up, I find that I am near a park bench. I wobble over to it and sit down. In my hand, I hold the proof, a suicide note from a woman I've never met. If I throw the piece of paper away, I'll leave Buckley heir to the vast farmlands of Arvin Hicks. All I have to do is drop this note into the nearest trash can, and I'm golden. I think about Jeremy. If I had money like that, I could do so much for him. I could set up a trust fund. He would never have to work. He would never want for anything. I could help other autistic kids, too. I could start a foundation. I would do that if I were a millionaire. I would be a good man that way. I swear.
A good man. Those three words ricochet back at me and strike me dumb.
Weren't those the words that Lila used as she held out her broken heart for me to see? I'm lying to myself again, trying to rationalize what I know to be wrong. Lila would be ashamed of me if she were here and knew what I was thinking. I hear her voice, soft and sad and all alone in my head. All you had to do was be a decent guy, and you couldn't do that. Every muscle in my body seems to slump forward, and I rest my elbows on my knees. I know what I must do. It's not my money, I say to no one. Nothing I do will ever change that. I'm the only one who can make this right. I stand, ready to walk to the sheriff's office, when it occurs to me that if I'm right about the note, which I know I am, the final turn of that combination lock clicking in my head will be found at Dub's repair. It's the key to what Toke did the night he died. I fold the note, put it in my pocket, and make my way to Dub's. Chapter 50.
You mind telling me what's so goddamn important that you can't tell me over the phone?
Kimble says, as he and Bob Mullen walk into the body shop.
I'm a bit curious myself, Bob says. And why here?
Kimble waves a hand at the walls of the body shop. Bob, I say, ignoring the sheriff. Did you ever read Jeannie's suicide note? He looks surprised at the question.
I never had a copy. So, no.
I say, I found a copy in Moody's file. Kimble, as if needing to explain it, says,
We found it under Angel's pillow. Thought it might be relevant to the investigation.
To Kimble, I say, You also kept a copy of the note in Jeannie's suicide file, because you thought there might be more to her death than a simple suicide.
We had some concerns, yeah.
In fact, you suspected that Toke might have had a hand in Jeannie's death.
Toke had an alibi.
Kimble pauses to look around the body shop.
He was working down here that night.
I pull the suicide note out of my pocket and hand it to Bob. This is her note. Give it a read and tell me what you think.
You stole her note from the file?
Kimble barks, though Bob is already reading the note, his eyes narrow.
This isn't right,
Bob says.
What's not right?
Kimble asks.
This letter. Jeannie was my legal assistant. She was proficient with grammar. So?
Kimble says.
There are errors in this note. She writes make do, spelling it D-U-E instead of D-O. And goodbye is one word, not two. And so is outcome.
You may not know this, Kimble says, but Jeannie was under the influence of her anxiety medication when she committed suicide. She took enough pills that night that the drugs would have done the job if the news hadn't. We didn't release that to the public. Even knocked out on meds, I can't see Jeannie writing this note. There are no commas in the whole thing. I used to call Jeannie my comma Nazi because it drove her crazy when I'd skip a comma.
And look how she spelled Bapu, I say. Bob reads.
B-A-P-O-O.
He looks up at me, his mouth open, trying to speak words that his mind can't find.
What?
Kimble asks. I turn to Kimble. Jeannie had a nickname for her father. She called him Bapu, B-A-P-U. It's a term of fatherly endearment in Hindi. She would never misspell that, no matter how many meds she was on. I pause to let Kimble catch up. Then, I say, Yesterday, my mom showed me a letter that Toke wrote after he was arrested for assaulting her. I pull Toke's letter from my back pocket, where it had been since leaving Mom's house, and hand it to Bob. Sheriff Kimble leans in to read it as well. I continue talking as they read. He made two of those same mistakes. He misspelled both make do and outcome, spelling them the same way they appear in the suicide note.
Toke wrote Jeannie's suicide note,
Bob whispers.
What about his alibi?
Kimble says.
None of this matters because he had an alibi.
Follow me, I say, leading them into the guts of the body shop. Greg Dubinsky is waiting for us and shakes hands with Bob and Sheriff Kimble as we walk in. Then I continue laying out the case. Toke knows that he's going to be suspected of killing Jeannie. He knows that he's going to need an alibi.
He was here working on his GTO, Kimball says. We have surveillance footage to back that up.
Toke knew about the surveillance cameras, I say. He knew they point at the parking lot and at the office. He knew that he'd been seen coming in and leaving. But when he's working on the car, there's no camera on that. All he has to do is slip out that window. I point at a row of windows lining the back wall of the shop. He slips out, stages Jeannie's suicide, and slips back in, letting Angel find her mother hanging in the barn.
That's a nice theory, Kimball says, and I'm willing to bet that it's true, but we need proof.
We're getting there, I say, but there's another aspect that we need to cover. We now know that Toke wasn't Angel's father. Toke knew it too. That fact changes everything.
I can see the wheels turning in Sheriff Kimball's head, but they're not spinning fast enough for my taste, so I come at it from another angle.
Start from the end and work backward. The night that Toke died, what if he was planning to kill Angel? Bob looks aghast. Why would he do that? He already had the inheritance.
But Jeb found Jeannie's suicide note under Angel's pillow, alongside a photograph of Jeannie, Angel, and Hicks, I say.
On the back of that picture, Jeannie wrote, "My Bapu, my baby, and me." Bapu, B-A-P-U. Angel had her mom's suicide note with Bapu misspelled. That's the night she texted Moody, saying that she was freaking out. What if she put it together? What if she understood that her father had killed her mother?
Toke must have caught wind that Angel was on to him, Bob says. Maybe Angel confronted him, or maybe he found what she had under her pillow. That still doesn't get us past the alibi when Jeannie died,
Kimball says.
On the surveillance tape, we saw shadows moving around in here,
Kimball says.
His brother Charlie?
Bob asks.
Believe it or not, Kimball says, we looked into that. Charlie had an airtight alibi that night, too.
Besides, I say, Toke and Charlie hated each other. It doesn't make sense that Toke would trust Charlie on something this risky. Charlie could blackmail him.
No,
Toke did this all by himself.
Actually, it was pretty simple.
I turn to Dub.
Go ahead, I say.
Dub clears his throat and says,
Toke has this GTO over here. The one he bought from Harley Redding.
Dub points to a car in the farthest bay, a sleek black muscle car with gray patches of Bondo covering parts of its side.
A little while ago, he asked me if I could use that bay to work on the car. He was willing to pay me, now that he had money. Well, one morning, I came in here and, well, come look.
Dub leads the three of us to the GTO. Behind the rear bumper lay a hand lamp and an oscillating fan with a balloon attached to it by a piece of thread.
This ain't the same balloon I found here the morning after Toke got killed, but Joe here asked me to set it up the way I found it, so there it is.
I turn on the fan, and it begins to move back and forth, stirring the balloon, making it dance in front of the light in a random pattern. We all look at the wall by the office door to see the shadow of the balloon on the wall, simulating a man passing in and out of the light.
Is that what the surveillance cameras picked up on the night of Jeannie's death? I ask.
That dog,
Kimball whispers.
Did Toke say he was coming in to work on his car the night he died?
He didn't have to,
Dub says.
He had a key and I was up in Glencoe that night for my mom's birthday. I found the balloon and the fan and stuff that next morning. I kicked it to the side and didn't think much about it, other than it was kind of weird to have the balloon here. But Toke could be a weird guy sometimes.
I say, I had Dub pull the surveillance footage from the night that Toke died.
Got it all queued up, Dub says, in case you want to see it, but yeah, Toke came in here that night.
Does the footage show him leaving?
Kimball asks.
No, it shows him coming in, and then there were those shadows on the wall like we just done. I never saw him leave.
Kimball rubs the scruff on his chin.
Well, I'll be damned. He tried to set up the same alibi.
That's why he started beating Moody with a coil of rope, I say. He was going to use the rope to make Angel's death look like a copycat suicide. Moody interrupted Toke's plan. Then Vicky finished him off. He never made it back here to clean up the balloon or walk out on camera. Bob says,
Angel's overdose wasn't an overdose at all. Toke drugged her to get her out to the barn. He was going to hang her the same way he did Jeannie. Moody saved her life,
Kimball says in a quiet voice. What about Vicky? I ask. Will this affect her case?
Bob says, Unfortunately, what Vicky did is still murder. True, the man she killed was a monster, but under the law, that doesn't matter. That may be so, Kimball says, but I doubt the folks in this county will have much of a stomach for punishing her once they hear about this. Hell, they'll probably want to give her a medal.
Mullen nods his agreement.
I'm sure there'll be a damned good plea offer made. The county attorney's up for election next year. I doubt he'll be out for blood on this one.
Then Bob turns to me and, with a serious look on his face, says,
Joe, you understand what this means for you, don't you?
I nod. The Slayer statue, I say.
The Slayer statue? Kimball asks.
Bob says,
A man can't benefit from killing someone. He can't inherit if he murders the person he's inheriting from. It's called the Slayer statute. When Hicks died, the farm passed to Jeannie. When Jeannie died, the whole estate went to Toke. After yesterday and the revelation that Angel isn't Toke's daughter, Joe here is the sole heir to the Hicks estate.
Okay, Kimball says.
I'm with you so far.
Bob continues.
But Toke can't inherit the estate from Jeannie if he killed Jeannie. That transfer will become null and void because of what Joe just uncovered here.
Kimball gives me a puzzled look and then a sad smile.
So by figuring all this out, Joe just cut himself off from inheriting the Hicks estate.
Exactly, Bob says.
And you knew this when you called us down here?
Kimball asks.
I knew it, I say. But it's not my money. I don't want it. I've made it this far without Toke Talbert giving me a goddamn thing. I don't see a need to change that now.
Well, that's not entirely true, Bob says.
I'm confused, and I'm sure my face shows it. I had worked through the falling dominoes at least a dozen times, and every time, the last domino to fall was my inheritance. What am I missing? I say.
Toke Talbert did have one possession that doesn't belong to the Hicks estate. One piece of property that's in his name, and his name only.
I shake my head, still lost. Bob nods at the GTO.
I understand you might be in need of a car.
Chapter 51. The next morning, I wake up on the top bunk of a bed that had been Jeremy's and mine since before I had a memory. The same bed I had lain in when I swore that I would never lift a finger to find my father. I could hear Mom already moving around the kitchen. Apparently, without alcohol, drugs, and depression to sedate her, she's a morning person. I find her at the table reading a book. She's a reader now as well. She offers to make me something to eat, but I beg off.
Cup of coffee, at least?
Sure, I say, and sit at the table while she pours water into her coffee maker.
Are you going back to Buckley?
No, I have to go to St. Paul. Lila will be finishing up with the bar exam this afternoon.
You should buy her some flowers or something.
Yeah, I probably should.
You know, Joe, you're lucky to have someone in your life like that. Never take that for granted.
Actually, I scratch at a tiny stain on the table. I can't make eye contact, or I won't be able to finish my sentence. Lila and I are... I'm not really sure where things stand with us.
I'm sorry to hear that, Joe.
My fault, not hers. I messed it up. Mom nods as if she understands, even though I don't go into the details. Then she says,
Joe, I know a thing or two about messing stuff up. What you see here?
She gives a short twirl of her finger to indicate the apartment around us.
This is me at my best. I get up every day and pray that I don't mess it up again.
Her hands fidget as she speaks, one hand rubbing the other as if trying to warm the stiffness from her joints.
Do you remember that picture that used to hang over there?
She points to a blank wall in the living room.
The one where you're holding Jeremy when he was a baby?
At the guardianship hearing, she accused me of smashing it over Jeremy's head. I don't say that, of course.
I have it in my room now.
I see it every morning when I wake up. I put it there to remind me of what I lost when I became an addict.
Whenever I feel like I can't do it anymore, I look at that picture and remember what I did to you and your brother. I used to pray that one day I'd have you both back. I knew that it would only happen if I stayed in recovery.
I'm proud of you, I say, more than you can imagine. She smiles at that.
You have no idea how happy I am to hear you say that.
Her eyes start to glisten. She reaches out her hand and puts it on my wrist.
And to have Jeremy here, asleep in his bed, I'm about as happy as a mother could be.
Speaking of Jeremy, I say, do you think you could keep him for another day or so?
Nothing would make me happier.
I'm not sure how things are going to go with Lila.
If you love Lila, don't give up. Forgiveness isn't easy, and it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, look at me. It's taken me 30 years and a lot of therapy to forgive myself for what happened to my mother. And there's a lot I'm still working on. It takes time. Sometimes maybe even years. But don't give up.
I take a moment to admire my mother, something that I had never done before. She seems so calm in her new skin. It's easy to forget about the havoc that used to inhabit that body. What she says gives me solace, and I'm ashamed that it surprises me to find wisdom laced in her words. I tuck her sentiment away in a place that has been empty for a long time. Mom gets up to pour my coffee, and my phone buzzes in my pocket. For a second I think that it might be Lila, but then I remember that she should be sitting for the second day of the bar exam, and they don't allow phones in the room. I pull my phone out and look. It's from Allison at the AP office.
Any chance you could stop by today?
I am reminded that today is the day that the follow-up article on Senator Dobbins is going to post. The day that I'm quitting my job. I suppose there's a procedure we have to go through. She probably wants me to get my stuff out of there before they change the passcode on the door. I type back, I'll stop by this afternoon. Then I go to the website to read the article, but they haven't posted it yet. I think about Penny, my source, and her fear that she might lose her family over this. The desperation in her voice as she made me promise to keep her secret. I failed her, too. Chapter 52. I arrive in the Twin Cities still wearing the clothing I wore when I escaped the motel fire, and Jeb's shirt. I think about going to the apartment to get some new clothes, but I would be disrespecting Lila's wishes. Instead, I spend part of my morning shopping at a thrift store for something to wear that doesn't smell like smoke. I spend another few hours sitting in the grass at Minnehaha Falls, under an ever-graying sky, pondering where to start my search for a new job. I eat my lunch, a convenience store granola bar and banana, in my car. My GTO. After stalling for as long as I can, I drive downtown to meet with Allison. The other reporters in the room look up as I pass by on my way to Allison's office. Gus is the only one to smile. Allison's door is open, but I knock anyway. When she sees me, she says, "You look like hell." I'm bent over slightly because of my bruised rib, and I have a few cuts on my face and neck from crawling through that mirror. "I feel like hell," I say. She motions for me to take a seat, and I do.
"You haven't posted the story yet," I say.
"The story's not going out,"
Allison smiles as she gives me this good news.
"Senator Dobbins dropped his lawsuit."
Of all the directions that our conversation might turn, I didn't expect that one.
Why?
It took some talking, but I managed to convince the folks in legal that your story was true. If that was the case, then the lawsuit they brought hinged on the senator's confidence that we would rather retract the story than name the source. We called his bluff.
So the follow-up story?
I wrote it yesterday.
Allison says, serious now. We were planning on publishing it today, but we wanted to give the senator and his wife an opportunity for comment. We sent them the story, telling them that we were forced to do the follow-up because of the lawsuit. We gave them a day to respond, promising to include any comment they wanted us to include. I suspect that his wife was the one who pulled the plug. Regardless, they dropped their suit this morning.
What about Penny? I ask. Did you show her the article?
No, Allison says, lowering her voice a little. I was supposed to, but I didn't. I kept imagining that poor woman confessing the affair to her husband to get ahead of the article. I didn't want that to happen unless I was 100% sure that the story would post. And I was never 100% sure of that.
You bluffed the senator? I say.
She smiles again. I guess I did. I glance through the glass wall that separates Allison's office from the worker bees and see my empty workstation.
I'm sorry I put you in that bind, I say.
You were doing your job, Joe. I approved the story because it was important. We had a state senator beating his wife to the point of unconsciousness, and he was going to get away with it. I'm really proud that you were willing to lay it on the line to get that story out. You did the right thing, Joe. No matter how it might have turned out, you should never regret that.
So where does that leave us?
It leaves us where we were before all this crap happened. You said you would quit if I published the story. I didn't publish it. So the way I see it, you have a job whenever you're ready to come back.
A sense of relief washes over me. I have a job again. Or still. I thank Allison repeatedly and tell her that I'll start back to work in the morning. She really is a good boss. My rendezvous with Lila is fast approaching, and I'm nervous as hell. She's in Brooklyn Center, a suburb of Minneapolis, sitting at a table at the Earl Brown Heritage Center, filling in little ovals with her number two pencil. 8 hours of multiple choice questions. I know that the afternoon session ends at 4:30, but I want to be there early. I want her to see me as she walks out. I'll know by looking in her eyes whether my sin is forgivable. The parking lot is full, but I find a space in the farthest back row. The sky has grown appropriately gloomy, with a ceiling of gray clouds gathering above me to bear witness to my fate. A few raindrops tap my head and shoulders as I stand outside the entrance, holding a black-eyed Susan I stole from Minnehaha Park. It's a little after 4, and the first bleary-eyed lawyer wannabes are beginning to wander out. That trickle grows until they are coming out 2 abreast. At 4:30, the test is called, and the bodies pour out in a flood. Near the end of the surge, I see Lila, and my breath catches in my chest. It's like I'm seeing her for the first time, the dust of my own complacency now wiped clean. She doesn't see me at first. She's talking to some guy walking beside her. He's tall and handsome, and she's smiling up at him, the way she used to smile at me. I know it's only my imagination, but that doesn't mean it hurts any less. She sees me, and her smile falls away. The guy looks confused for a second before he too sees me. Then he says something to Lila and walks away. Lila remains in the doorway, a stone in a stream, as the last few people part and flow around her. I wait for a smile, but it doesn't come. We stare at each other as time freezes around us. Then she shakes her head, looks down at the sidewalk, and walks away. I'm gutted. Nothing inside of me. I want to follow her, chase her. I want to convince her that she's wrong, but how can I? I did this. I walk back toward my car but pass it by and keep walking until I get to a small knoll at the edge of the property, a strip of grass lined with pine trees and a white fence. I let the black-eyed Susan fall to the ground before I sit in the grass and bury my face in my arms. I close my eyes and see 6 years of memories playing out in my mind. Even in the worst of times, life with Lila was good. I should be crying, but that seems too self-serving. She's doing what she needs to do to protect herself. I understand that. Soon, the sound of cars leaving the parking lot dies away. And I'm pretty sure that I am alone. That's when I hear a sound of something on the grass near me. I look up and see Lila sitting against the fence just beyond my reach.
I don't know how long she's been there, but she's watching me in silence.
You really hurt me, Joe, she says. I don't think you know how much.
The words, I'm sorry, seem inadequate, but I say them anyway.
Why?
She asks.
That's what I want to know.
Why did you do it? I don't understand. I look back at the ground so that I can keep my composure. I've been asking myself that question. I've been beating myself up trying to understand it, but everything I come up with is weak and pitiful. The truth is, there is no excuse for what I did.
I'm not enough for you?
Her question spills out like it had been on the tip of her tongue for days. Enough for me? I look hard into her eyes. What I'm about to say is the most honest thing I've ever told her, and I need her to believe me. Lila, you are the love of my life. If you walk away from me, you will still be the love of my life. It may be too late. I may have screwed this up beyond repair, but know that I will love you until the day I die. No matter what happens next, I just need you to know that. Lila looks at the grass beyond her feet as my words evaporate into nothing. The quiet between us grows until I can't take it anymore, and I try to fill the void. How'd the test go?
I'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Again, we return to an uncomfortable silence. I struggle to find something to say, finally coming up with, Jeremy's with Mom. She's doing really well.
I know,
Lila says. We talked.
You talked to Kathy?
When?
I called her last night. I wanted to see how Jeremy was doing. You know what she said?
I shake my head no.
She thinks I should give you another chance. Apparently, she doesn't believe that a person can be a lost cause.
I look at Lila, hoping to see a smile, but she continues to stare at the grass. What about you? I ask. Do you think I'm a lost cause? She hesitates before answering, and then says,
I don't believe in lost causes, remember?
She smiles a fragile smile, and it means everything to me. I'm not a millionaire, I say, thinking that I needed her to know that for some reason.
I never thought you were.
And I don't have a sister. I did for a while, but not really. Lila gives me an expression of confusion.
Was the man who died, was he your father?
He was, and I think the whole world should be thankful that he's gone. It's a long story. Oh, and my car got burned up.
Your car got...
She looks around the parking lot.
Then how do you get here?
I point at the GTO, parked all alone about 30 feet away from us. Calico patches of body putty running down its side. That's part of the long story. Now she smiles a genuine smile. In spite of herself, I think. She picks up the black-eyed Susan lying near her feet and twirls it gently in her fingers.
Maybe we should go home and you can tell me this story of yours, she says.
Home. I whisper the word to myself. And it makes me think of something that Bob Mullen said. Sometimes home isn't a place, it's a person. I take a slow breath in and smell the crisp scent of grass and pine and hope.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Shadows We Hide, written by Alan Eskins, read by Zach Villa, produced by Lisa Kahn, directed by Dennis Kao, recorded by Dennis Kao at Literati Audio Studios in Hollywood, California, post-production by A1 Sound Studio. The Shadows We Hide is also available in print and digital formats from Mulholland Books, an imprint of Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018, Alan Eskins. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.